Noticing kind of a rapid heartbeat, and a little bit of tension between my hara and my solar plexus, kind of going like that. And I want to talk today about relaxing. And so this is how can I sit up here and really practice relaxing. So good morning. Buenos dias. It's the second day of Sesshin. And from meeting with many of you last night in interview, I see that it's working. There's a saying that might sound familiar, we're up against the wall. And there's nowhere to go. And so all of our own personal demons come out, the ones that are kind of hiding behind the doors that we usually just don't pay attention to. They're kind of showing up. Some of our fantasies are rising up, and some of the demons can be very pleasant too. They can have faces of angels and goddesses or gods. Our pain can come up, physical, psychological. It's no different, really. And so what's working is that all of the strategies that we usually have to manage all of this are getting pushed up against. You know, we can't escape and go have our latte. You know, we can't just take that extra 5 minutes to do, you know, the things that we feel are necessary for us to get ourselves together. We have to show up for other people. If we're a loner, we're here amongst all these people, and we're probably working right next to the one who we really can't stand, even though we don't know them. And so the tendency right now about this time in session is to really feel like it's not working. Like somehow your decision to come here was really wrong and you wish you could reconsider, and maybe there's like, you know, a way you could sneak out and no one would notice. So it's like that is just the right time, right about now. As Roshi said, it's designed specifically to do this. And so for me, like many of you probably, when something feels like it's wrong, the usual tendency is to try to go ahead and fix it. I've noticed this in relationship with people. Like they'll be telling me their problem, and they'll tell me how difficult it is, and meanwhile, not even hearing what the problem is, I'm like going ahead and trying to figure out a solution. And so if you're the one who's standing there watching things go awry, and the person who's supposed to do their job is not doing it, don't worry, you can relax and not do it yourself. You don't need to step in and tell that person that they need to go that way, not that way. The practice is to hold the container, to hold the container for each other, but also just for you to be able to hit up against that wall that says, I'm the one who has to do it. Something's going to really go wrong if I don't say something now. I know, because I do that all the time. And so Roshi said that Sesshin is designed to be harsh. What do I mean by harsh? By harsh, I mean unsympathetic, difficult, uncomfortable, not patronizing, rigid. So yeah, if you're feeling any of that, like what happened to a compassionate, loving people, you're in the right place. This is exactly right. Because as Roshi reminded us, this practice is not about feeling good. It's not about some kind of sense of compassion or love. It's about liberation. It's about true liberation. So when someone says that thing to you, or you feel like a fool when you go into interview and you totally flub it and you had rehearsed it before and it was like really good, but it doesn't work out when you go face to face, hey, that's part of the liberation, to be right there, to relax into that. So we all come in with what an idea of practice is, what an idea of liberation or enlightenment is. And when something arises, we don't see that the problem is the solution. Dogen says in the Fukan Zazenge, do not think good or bad, do not administer pros and cons. Cease all the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. Have no expectations. He doesn't say that, Roshi did. Little substitution there. And there's the haiku poet amongst our myths who says, rocky trail, mountain blueberries, trip me up. And in the second haiku, our assistant Tenzo Poet Fugan says, rocky trail, composing haiku, trips me up. So this thing that trips us up is the solution. We want to be tripped up. It's not to stay on the rocky trail and be really hard-working Zen students, but we want to get tripped up. The tripping up is the Dharma. But we get so caught up in being right that we miss the space in between. The space between the thoughts, between one step and the next in Kinhin. We just see the thing we're going after. Another local poet by the name of Chodo says, noticing the space between green leaves and gray clouds, the span of my life. So we don't notice the space unless we see what's in it, right? Unless we see our delusion, unless we see, like the moment I was out back, I'm sitting there working on this talk, and all of a sudden, yellow leaves filled the whole backyard. And I could see the space. Because of the leaves, I could see the space. It goes unnoticed otherwise. our life goes unnoticed unless we get tripped up. Jill Bolte Taylor, the brain scientist who some years ago had a stroke and wrote My Stroke of Insight, talks about these definitions between space and form, or between one form and another, that we see and we define one thing from another, that's a construct of the brain. She knew, because she lost that part of her brain, it got stroked out, and so all of a sudden there were no boundaries. So she couldn't see the space and she couldn't see the thing. It was all one. Big problem. Big problem. How do you exist and live in that space? So if you have an idea that's what it's about, well, don't get stroked out, but that's not it. In the study week, well, it's kind of interesting because I'm talking about this, and you'll see later on in the talk, for my own good, really. I always came to the hard parts of the ango. You know, if I couldn't do the whole thing, I'd come to the sessions, you know, or maybe I'd do precepts because I had to, you know, work it. And it's been many, many years since I've come to the Zen study, or even some years since I've done the writing workshop, which kind of felt like Zen light, you know. You have more breaks, you get up at 6 o'clock, you might want to reconsider. And so it was actually quite wonderful. I had been away in Bolivia part of the time with Sangha, with my Dharma brother Shinryu, and I got quite sick. And the theme of the retreat was Dogen's Drop Body and Mind, so it was actually quite appropriate. And I have to thank you for that. I really learned a lot with that particular experience, which I won't go into right now. But going into retreat, into the study week, we did poetry, which I thought, oh, wow, that's pretty easy. And I get here and Roshi says, I really want you to relax and rest. So I thought, wow, how am I going to be practicing? So my Dharma name, if you don't know it, is Anraku. And like my Dharma brother Shinryu, it's from the Fukan Zazengi. Enkyo Roshi chose it for both of us from that piece of Dogen. And my name means peace, ease, and bliss. And one translation is the Dharma gate of Zazen. Zazen is the Dharma gate of this peace and bliss. The Dharma gate of repose, rest, relaxation. Contrary to what I thought of myself or what I thought of Zen, I believe that I have been referred to as a kind of Zen fanatic, or Zen, in a less lovable term, Zen Nazi at times in my history. And so the joke was that Roshi was kind of giving me one of those subliminal messages, like, chill out, you know. This was about 9 years ago, so I'm still working on this. A couple weeks ago, a lot of other people received Dharma names. I'm sure some of them liked them, and I know at least one person who did not. But like all Dharma names, they're a point of practice. I could see how peace and ease were products of Zen practice, you know, like at the end of practice, you see the Zen masters walking so at ease through the gardens, you know, just taking their time, stories of Suzuki Roshi waiting for someone who doesn't show up for an hour and just blissfully standing on the corner, no urgency or place to go. In fact, Zen, with its roots in Taoism, talks about wei wu wei. Am I saying that right? Wei wu wei. Doing, non-doing. Doing without doing, or doing through practice and concentration. With total freedom and absolute creativity. Yeah, I wanted that. I wanted that. But what I didn't see is that relaxation and ease does not depend on circumstance. I didn't see that. And Dogen says again, if there is the slightest discrepancy, the way is as distant as heaven from earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So we're told in practice, when we sit on the cushion, be one with whatever arises. It's not two. So in the midst of our agitation, in the midst of our thoughts, that's the practice. It's not this place to get to. So for me, this koan has been, how do I relax? Most of you know that I have worked with the body for a long time as a dancer, through a lot of different neuromuscular re-education techniques, that I'm a chiropractor now in my practice. And my first memories of my body, I was kind of going back, and it was even pre-verbal. I just have this memory of being forced to take naps. And the feeling was that there was my mother and I was the firstborn. So I must have been really little, because my feeling sense was that there was this big kind of like, you know, whale, a big body next to me. And so I imagine that I must have been really teeny. You know those whales out in California on the seacoast? Not whales, they're seals, right? They're elephant seals. And they kind of have all this blubber, and they roll into each other and on top of each other and make these sounds. And it was kind of like that shape in my consciousness. When I go back, and the feeling in my body, I can still recall, it was kind of like this agitation, like, I want to do something, you know? And I remember my mother rolling over and say, Kathy, go to sleep. Just be still. Must be some kind of karmic connection that this is what I have to do on the cushion. Just be still. I didn't know how to rest. I felt that there was always something to do. And in fact, that's what I was told, is that you are what you do. The Calvinist tradition, which I was brought up in, my dad being a minister, was you are seen by the work that you do. That's the measure of a person, is what you do. So to sit back and not do, that was lazy. That was a lazy person. That was a good for nothing. And so that feeling is in my body. And so when I hear the word relax, be at ease, on a physical body sense, it's disturbing to me. I heard from a friend that Pema Chodron has said one of the main points in practice is to relax. One of the main points in practice is to relax. So I saw myself as a Zen person, and this was a Tibetan thing. The Theravadan people walk slow and eat slow, and they're relaxed. But Zen people? No. We don't do that. We sit with an intensity as if a fire were burning on top of our heads. And yet, this Dharma name. So when we sit on the cushion, we sit with our bodies. Part of the point of that is discovering what we do. For a long time when I sat on the cushion, I sat with a certain rigidity of form and structure that said, I have to count to 10. I have to get to 10, that's the object of this, I'm going to get there no matter what. And so a thought would come up, and I'd push it away and come back to my practice of one. I had to sit with that rigidity in my body. Bit by bit, I began to see what that was doing for myself. So I wouldn't recommend doing that. We want to be completely one with what arises. We have a focus to focus our breath in the hara, and we use the counts as a way to link our mind, what we think are two, mind and body, as one. A thought arises, a feeling, an emotion, something we think is not Zen or not practice, arises. See it. See it. When we really allow our awareness to fill it without feeding it, it has nowhere to go. We don't do it. We let it go. Just like that sound. We're with it. And then it goes. It's there again. Just like a thought. Just like a feeling. You must see it. We need to bear witness to ourselves. And then there's a space. Without the thought, without really seeing the emotion, without seeing and experiencing our bodies, we can't see the space. We can't see that, how did Chodo say it, the space between. And so as Sensei Joshin directed us, we non-judgmentally observe our mind, observe our body. And in this observation, we enter into it. And we see ourselves, the self that we, from a little bitty one, took on as this person that we, on an energetic level, feel we are. And it begins to unpeel like this onion. This anxiety went unnoticed for many, many years. And as I began to unpack that, I began to see that this core anxiety was something that had run me in my life. It had led me into my addictions. It had directed me in terms of my relationships, my sense that I couldn't do it. That it had tethers to many, many different things. We all have underneath the thoughts, a body experience that lies there. So see the thoughts, feel the emotions, and sit. Relax into that fire in your belly completely. The relaxation is not laziness, it's complete absorption, complete letting go in the midst of that fire. You can do it. This structure, our teacher, the Sangha, the community, this space itself has done it. It's particularly designed for that. Trust. Practicing ease and peace does not mean having this kind of veneer of ease, like some kind of perfect, nauseating Zen patina. Make mistakes, not intentionally, but that's the trick. Synchronistically, while I was preparing for this talk, I was walking down in the basement of Grail House and up the back stairs, and there's a secret room that was open, and this secret room had National Geographics from the 70s and all kinds of religious, probably mostly Catholic, books that smelled really musty. And somehow this one book jumped out at me. And as I asked Darshuso the meaning of synchronicity, I said, well, that means that, you know, things that happen are supposed to happen. Or he said, kind of gave me the Jungian response. And I said, well, that means that, like, everything that shows up in our life is, like, meant to show up at that particular time. And he said, no, that goes into the religious aspect. So I'm hoping he'll explain that to me later at another point. But synchronistically, this book jumped out, and it's called Spirituality and the Gentle Life. And it's by Adrian Van Kam, who's a CSSP, who I think is some Catholic order. He says, and I thought this was in honor of Arshuso, who does bridge these two traditions in my attempt here. During certain cultural periods, whole generations may play at being gentlemen, that veneer. Their gentleness may be no more than an outward imitation of genteel manners that characterize the socially privileged. We are privileged. A surface gentility like that would be useless for growth in sanctity. In no way would it ready man for the experience of the indwelling of the divine in self, others, and nature. Some people may suspect an inner emptiness or void behind outer gentility. This feeling may explain the scornful way they react to the smooth behavior of the accomplished gentleman. We've all seen that, right? How we hate that person who's doing it so well, so perfectly. And we think, they're not really a real person. And he goes on, they may not really trust him. Something about him makes them cautious lest they be taken in. On occasion, their intuition may be right. Gentleness is so attractive and winning a quality, soothing for body and soul, that a clever man of the world who despises gentleness deep down may still imitate its outward manifestation. He may feign its appearance to further his self-centered aims. I guess for me, that really speaks to that kind of outer shell of Zen practice that many of us, I know for myself, try to maintain or have tried at certain points in practice to maintain. And he says that it doesn't help if we don't expose that inner. doesn't mean we should give up on the practice, though. He says the experiences of failure are like the negative of the photo. By showing what true gentility is not, they show me indirectly what the real thing may be. We all know that, huh? When we totally flub it, you know, like I did the other day, somehow I came stomping in here saying, it's too early, with the sense of righteousness, like somehow I had the correct time, and everyone else was wrong. Well, I could really see how I had lost my patience, my ease at that moment. It's great to see. If we get lost in the failure and the justification, we're back at square one. Notice the judge. Come back to the moment. Come back to your body. We have to probe deeper, he says, to the deeper meaning of such simple gestures and experiences whose significance we rarely follow through in thought and life. We don't think them through because they are familiar. Our very familiarity with them makes us take them for granted. What is most near to us seems most to resist our reflection. What's closest, what we hold most dear, our time that we go to sleep, our simple ways that we kind of ruminate about things. Those things that lie so close, that become familiar. This box that we're sitting in, let's hope that we hit those. Let's hope that we run up against that familiar. When our bodies fall apart, when all of a sudden I think, great, I'm home free and poison ivy. You know, that's those familiar things that we take for granted in our privileged state. Let's not miss. Can we relax into our anger, our rage, our heartbreak? Can we relax completely into it without feeding it the fuel of the familiar story, the familiar place that it goes to next to continue it rolling? Can we just drop into this moment? And if you don't want to do it the Zen way, you can just listen to Jill Bolte Taylor again, who says that it's the 90-second rule. Any emotion that comes up, if you just stay with it, 90 seconds and it's gone. You're on to something else. Let it go. And if it was hot, as it was yesterday, we don't know. Today's pretty comfortable. Might have been better for practice being hot. Great to sit with the sweat running down your spine and not have an opinion about, oh, this is not good. To watch the rivulets on your own close body and realize that it's not personal. The day didn't do it to you. Or maybe it did. Maybe the day did it just for you to wake up. This harshness of Zen practice is a gift. Leave the courtesies behind, the said ones and the unsaid ones, the ones you say to yourself to forgive yourself, to keep you from feeling. Relax into it. The whole world has conspired for you for this particular moment. Whatever it is, it couldn't be any other way. There's a poem I'd like to end with by an anonymous nun I didn't see many nuns in that collection, I must say, but this one popped out, and it just happened to be an anonymous nun from the Sung Dynasty. And she goes, "Searching for spring all day, I never saw it. Straw sandals treading everywhere, among the clouds, along the bank. Coming home, I laughed, catching the plum blossom scent. Spring, at each branch tip, already perfect." I'll read it once more. "Searching for spring all day, I never saw it. Straw sandals treading everywhere, among the clouds, along the bank. Coming home, I laughed, catching the plum blossom scent. Spring at each branch tip, already perfect." Sentient beings are